The bishop had been speaking for 9 minutes when the Duke of Northmere leaned toward his bride and said, in a voice pitched for her ear alone, "I expect obedience in all things. You will find it simpler." 300 guests filled the pews of St. Bartholomew's. The June light fell through the east windows in broad, pale columns, catching the dust motes that drifted above the congregation like a second silent audience. The altar flowers, white roses and myrtle, as was proper, had been arranged since dawn by the Northmere gardener, who had been told twice that morning that they must be perfect. Everything must be perfect. The Duke of Northmere had said so, and when the Duke of Northmere said a thing, the world around him rearranged itself accordingly. Emmeline Bryce heard him clearly. She did not turn her head. She was aware of the bishop's voice continuing above them, something about the duties of Christian marriage, the sacred bond, and she was aware of the weight of the ivory muslin gown she wore, which had been made in 9 days by a seamstress in Bath who had wept with gratitude for the commission. She was aware of her father in the third pew, his hands folded over his prayer book, his expression carefully composed into something he hoped resembled happiness. Reverend Matthias Bryce had agreed to this marriage because the living at Fulwood was ending, and the bishop's fund would not stretch to cover a clergyman with 3 daughters and no connections worth mentioning. He had agreed because Emmeline herself had told him she understood what was being offered and what was being asked, and that she could bear it. She had meant it. She had walked into this church with clear eyes and steady hands and the full understanding that she was exchanging her freedom for her family's survival. And she had considered that a fair transaction, because Emmeline Bryce had never had the luxury of considering any transaction unfair simply because it cost her something. But she had not agreed to disappear. 3 seconds passed. She counted them by the rhythm of her own breathing. Then she turned, not to the Duke, but to the bishop, and said, with a composure so absolute that 3 women in the front pews would later describe it as terrifying, "I do not." Bishop Ogilvy stopped speaking. His mouth remained open for a full second afterward, a detail that would be reported in at least 4 drawing rooms before nightfall. He was 63 years old. He had performed over 2,000 marriage ceremonies in his 41 years of ministry, and in not one of them had a bride turned to him mid-ceremony and contradicted a statement that had not technically been addressed to her. He looked at Emmeline, he looked at the Duke. He looked back at Emmeline as though hoping she might clarify that she had been speaking to someone else. "I beg your pardon," Bishop Ogilvy said. "I do not," Emmeline repeated, in precisely the same tone. "Expect to offer obedience in all things or find it simpler." The silence that followed was unlike any silence Emmeline had experienced. It was not the silence of an empty room or a country lane at dusk. It was the silence of 300 people holding their breath at once, and it had a weight to it, a physical density that pressed against her chest and her temples and the thin skin of her wrists where her pulse beat with remarkable steadiness. The Duke of Northmere did not move. He stood precisely where he had stood for the previous 9 minutes. Tall, immaculate in a dark blue tailcoat with ivory silk waistcoat, his jaw set in the expression of a man who has never been publicly contradicted and cannot quite locate the mechanism by which one responds to it. His hands, which had been clasped loosely behind his back, shifted. That was all. A small motion. But Emmeline noticed, because Emmeline noticed everything, and she filed it alongside the 16 other observations she had made about Lucian Hale in the 4 occasions she had been in his company before this morning. He was not cruel. That was the first thing she had determined at their second meeting, when he had spoken to a footman who spilled wine and had been curt but not vicious. He was not stupid. That was the second thing, established during a dinner at which he had discussed the drainage reforms in the northern counties with more precision than any man present. He was not unkind. That was the third thing, noted when he had noticed her father's discomfort with the richness of the food at his table, and had quietly instructed a servant to bring a simpler plate. But he had spent 34 years being obeyed. Obeyed by servants, obeyed by tenants, obeyed by members of Parliament who sought his influence in the House of Lords, obeyed by his mother, obeyed by the succession of women who had been presented to him as potential brides over the past 6 seasons. He had been obeyed so completely and for so long that he had come to regard obedience not as a thing given, but as a natural condition, like gravity, something that simply existed in his presence. Emmeline Bryce was not gravity. She was a clergyman's daughter from Fullwood with ink stains on her fingers and a thorough education in Latin, Greek, mathematics, and the particular resilience required of a woman who has been overlooked so consistently that she has had ample time to develop opinions. Bishop Ogilvie cleared his throat. Perhaps, he said, with the careful diplomacy of a man who had navigated church politics for 4 decades, we might pause the ceremony briefly. Yes, Emmeline said. I think that would be wise. The Duke said nothing. He turned and walked toward the vestry, and his stride was controlled but rapid, and the sound of his boots on the stone floor rang through the nave with a sharpness that made Lady Saxby, in the fourth pew, press her gloved hand to her mouth. Emmeline followed him. She did not rush. She walked at her own pace, her hands folded in front of her, and she was aware of every eye in the church fixed upon her back, and she did not alter her posture by a single degree. Reverend Bryce half rose from his seat as she passed, his face drained of all color, and she gave him the smallest nod, a nod that said, I know what I am doing, and please sit down. And he sat because his eldest daughter had been gently commanding him since she was 11 years old, and he had long since stopped pretending he could resist it. The vestry door closed behind them. It was a small room, dark oak paneling, a writing desk stacked with parish registers, a crucifix on the wall, and a window of plain glass that looked out onto the churchyard, where the June sun fell across the gravestones with the particular indifference of weather to human catastrophe. The Duke stood at the window with his back to her, and his shoulders were rigid, and his breathing was audible. You have humiliated me, he said, in front of every family of consequence in 3 counties. Yes, Emmeline said. She sat down in the chair beside the writing desk, because her legs were shaking, and she would rather he did not see it, and because sitting while he stood shifted the geometry of the room in a way she preferred. Would you like me to explain why, or would you prefer to be angry first? He turned. His expression was not what she expected. She had expected fury. The clean, uncomplicated fury of a man whose authority has been challenged. What she saw instead was fury, and something else beneath it, something unsettled, something almost curious, and she understood in that moment that Lucian Hale had not been surprised by anyone in a very long time, and did not entirely know what to do with the sensation. I would prefer, he said, each word placed with deliberate care. An explanation for why my bride has just refused to marry me in front of 300 witnesses. I have not refused to marry you, he stared at her. You said, and I recall this clearly, madam, as it occurred approximately 90 seconds ago. I do not. I said I do not expect to offer obedience in all things. I did not say I would not marry you. Those are different statements. She folded her hands in her lap. I came to this church prepared to be your wife. I came prepared to manage your household, to represent your name in society, to bear your children, and to conduct myself with the dignity your position requires. I did not come prepared to be your servant. If you wished for a servant, you might have saved yourself a ceremony and hired one. They are considerably less expensive. The silence that followed was 3 full breaths long. You are a clergyman's daughter, he said. Your family has nothing. Your father's living ends at Michaelmas. Your sisters have no prospects. You came to this altar because you had no other option, and you presumed to dictate terms. I came to this altar because I had no other option, she agreed. That does not mean I came without conditions. It means I was unable to state them earlier, because you never asked. She met his gaze. You arranged this marriage through my father. You discussed settlements with your solicitor. You informed me of the date by letter. At no point, Your Grace, did you inquire what I might require from this arrangement. You assumed I would require nothing, because you have spent your life surrounded by people who require nothing from you except the privilege of your attention. He opened his mouth, closed it. I am not ungrateful, Emmeline continued, and her voice was steady and clear and carried no anger whatsoever, which was perhaps the most disorienting thing about it. You are offering my family security. I understand the value of that, and I would not have agreed if I did not. But you whispered to me at the altar, Your Grace, where I stood in a church before God and your guests, that you expected obedience. And I decided in that moment that if I allowed that statement to pass unchallenged, every day of this marriage would be built on its foundation, and I would spend the rest of my life living inside a sentence I should have interrupted. Lucian Hale looked at her for a long time. The June light from the vestry window caught the side of his face, and she could see the fine tension in his jaw and the way his hands held at his sides, opened and closed once. "What do you want?" he said. "I want a marriage, not an arrangement. There's no difference." "There is every difference." She did not raise her voice. "An arrangement requires one party to be silent. A marriage requires both parties to speak. I am willing to be your wife, Your Grace. I am not willing to be your silence." He crossed the room, not toward her, toward the writing desk, where he placed both hands flat on the surface and stood with his head bowed for several seconds. She could see the tendons in the backs of his hands. She could hear his breathing settle from rapid to controlled, and she recognized the shift because she had performed the same negotiation with her own body every day of her life. "My mother chose you," he said without looking up, "because she said you were sensible." "I am sensible." Sensible women do not stop their own weddings. Sensible women stop them before the wrong vows are made. Correcting an error after it is sworn before God is considerably more difficult than correcting one before. He lifted his head. Something had changed in his expression. The fury was still there, but it had thinned, and beneath it she saw the thing she had noticed once before at the dinner when he had spoken about drainage reforms. The quick, restless intelligence of a man who had been given very few opportunities to use it against an equal. "You realize," he said, "that if we do not return to that church, this marriage does not happen. Your father loses everything. Your sisters lose everything." "Yes." "And you are still sitting there." "Yes." He straightened. He pulled the chair from the opposite side of the desk, sat down facing her, and for the first time since she had met him, looked at her not as a transaction, but as a person. "Tell me your conditions," he said. She told him. She spoke for 4 minutes without interruption, and she had clearly thought about every word before this day, because the conditions arrived in order, precisely stated, without repetition or excess. She wanted her own rooms, not banishment, but privacy. She wanted access to the library and permission to continue her studies. She wanted her father's living replaced, not with charity, but with a proper benefice arranged through the bishop's office so that Matthias Bryce might keep his dignity. She wanted her sisters provided for, modestly, not lavishly, with small dowries that would allow them choices. She wanted a voice in the management of the household. She wanted, when they appeared in public together, to be introduced as his wife and not his acquisition. He listened. He did not interrupt. When she finished, he sat in silence for a full minute, and she let the silence hold, because she understood that he was not deciding whether to agree. He was deciding what it meant that he wanted to. "The benefice," he said finally. "I will write to the bishop this week." "Thank you." "Your sisters, dowries of £400 each." "300 will do. We are not greedy." He looked at her sharply, and something moved at the corner of his mouth that was not quite a smile and was certainly not displeasure. "300 then. The library is yours whenever you wish. The household. We will discuss that after you have seen the house. I will not promise what I do not yet know you will want." "That is fair." "And when we appear in public," he said, and his voice had changed, quieter now, stripped of the formal distance he had maintained since their first meeting, "you will be introduced as my wife, because that is what you will be." She stood. He stood. They regarded each other across the writing desk in the vestry of St. Bartholomew's, and the distance between them was 3 feet, and the distance between what this marriage had been 30 minutes ago and what it was now could not be measured in any unit she knew. "Shall we return?" she said. "The guests will talk." The guests were always going to talk. Now they will talk about something interesting. He exhaled. It was not a laugh, but it was closer to a laugh than anything she had heard from him, and she held it in her memory like a coin she would examine later. They returned to the nave. The guests had not moved. 300 faces turned toward them with expressions ranging from horrified fascination to something that looked, in the case of Lady Saxby, remarkably like hunger for catastrophe. Bishop Ogilvie stood at the altar with his hands clasped, looking as though he had aged several years in the intervening 20 minutes. "Your Grace," the bishop said carefully, "are we to, that is, shall we proceed?" Lucian looked at Emmeline. "Shall we?" "We shall," she said. He offered his arm. She took it. And they walked back to the altar together, and the quality of the silence in the church had changed entirely. It was no longer shock, but something watchful, attentive, as though 300 people had simultaneously realized they were witnessing the beginning of a story rather than the end of one. The ceremony resumed. Bishop Ogilvy spoke more quickly than before, as though afraid of further interruption, and when he reached the vows, Emmeline spoke them clearly and without hesitation. Lucian spoke his with a weight she had not heard from him before, slowly, deliberately, as though he meant to remember the sound of each word. When it was done, he did not kiss her. That was not the custom. But he placed her hand on his arm as they turned to face the congregation, and his hand covered hers, and the pressure of his fingers was not possessive. It was something else, something tentative, as though he were holding something he had only just realized was not his by right. The wedding breakfast was held at Northmere Park, and it was exactly as grand as one would expect. 40 covers, the best silver, the rooms brilliant with candlelight despite the long summer evening, because the Dowager Duchess had ordered candles and the Dowager Duchess's orders, like her son's, were not questioned. Emmeline sat at the head of the table opposite her husband, and she ate her food, and she answered questions, and she smiled when smiling was appropriate, and she was aware at every moment of his eyes returning to her from the far end of the table with an expression she could not yet read. Lady Saxby leaned toward her neighbor during the third course. "She will be broken within the month," she said, not quite quietly enough. "Country clergy do not produce duchesses." Emmeline heard it. She continued eating. She did not look up. She had been hearing variations of that sentence her entire life, spoken by women who mistook volume for authority and rank for worth, and she had learned long ago that the most effective response was none at all. Silence, in Emmeline's experience, was not weakness. It was the sound of a woman who had decided that some voices did not merit the effort of reply. Lucian heard it too. She knew this because his knife paused against his plate for exactly 1 second before resuming. He did not look at Lady Saxby. He did not address the comment. But when the meal concluded and the guests moved into the drawing room, he crossed directly to Emmeline, took her arm, and walked her to the center of the room where every guest could see them, and said, loudly enough to carry, "My wife will lead the first set." They danced. Emmeline danced well. Her mother had insisted on it, though they could not afford a proper master, and she had learned from a retired dancing mistress in Fulwood who gave lessons in exchange for mending. Lucian danced with the precision of a man who had been trained from childhood, but halfway through the first figure, she felt his grip adjust, not commanding, but accommodating, and she understood that he was matching his steps to hers, not the other way around, and that this was the first concession he had made that she had not asked for. The weeks that followed were unlike anything the household at Northmere Park had experienced. Mrs. Fenn, who had kept house for the late Duke and now kept it for his son, reported to the kitchen on the third morning that the new Duchess had already toured every room, asked the names of every servant, and requested a full account of the household expenditure for the previous quarter. She had not demanded it. She had asked with a courtesy so thorough that it carried more authority than any demand. "She is a clergyman's daughter," Mrs. Fenn told Barrow, the steward, over tea. "She has been running a house on nothing her entire life. She will run this one on everything, and she will do it better than either of us." Barrow, who had managed the Northmere estate for 11 years and considered himself unshakable, said nothing. He had already seen the Duchess review the tenancy agreements and ask 2 questions that no one, including the Duke, had thought to ask. Lucian observed. That was the thing Emmeline had not expected, that his response to her conditions, to her quiet transformation of his household, would not be resistance, but attention. He watched her the way she had watched him during their courtship, cataloging details, filing them, constructing an understanding from fragments. She caught him listening outside the morning room while she met with Mrs. Fenn about the winter provisions. She found him in the library one evening, reading a volume she had left open on the desk, a treatise on agricultural reform that she had borrowed from his own shelves, and he had not closed it when she entered, but had instead asked her what she thought of the author's position on crop rotation. The Dowager Duchess observed all of this from the Dower House, where she had removed herself with conspicuous grace the day after the wedding. She had arranged the match. She had chosen Emmeline from a short list of 7 candidates, all of them more obviously suitable, because she had recognized in the clergyman's daughter a quality she could not quite name but trusted instinctively. When Mrs. Fenn reported the events of the first month, the Dowager listened without expression and then said, "Good. He needs someone who will not let him calcify." She did not visit the main house for 6 weeks. She understood that a new marriage required air, and that her son, for all his qualities, had a tendency to perform for an audience rather than exist without one. They talked. Not immediately. The first fortnight was polite, careful, two people circling the perimeter of an understanding that had not yet settled into shape. But slowly, over breakfasts that grew longer and evenings that ended later, the conversation deepened. He told her about the House of Lords, about the drainage bill he was championing, about the tedium of being expected to have opinions on everything, and the frustration of discovering that most of his peers' opinions were borrowed. She told him about Fulwood, about teaching her sister's mathematics, because the village school would not, about the particular exhaustion of being intelligent in a world that had no use for intelligent women who could not also provide a fortune. "You are angry about that," he said one evening in the library by the fire. "I was. I've converted it into something more useful." "What?" "Competence." The corner of his mouth moved. She had learned to read that motion. It was the closest he came to open amusement, and it appeared only when she said something he had not anticipated. She was collecting those moments. She did not examine why. It was Lady Saxby who forced the matter into the open. 6 weeks after the wedding, at a dinner hosted by the Countess of Harlow, Lady Saxby addressed Emmeline directly for the first time. "Tell me, Your Grace," she said, and the title dripped from her mouth like something distasteful. "Is it true that your father mends his own boots? I heard it from Lady Pomeroy, who heard it from the curate at Fulwood. Such a charming detail. One so rarely meets a duchess whose family maintains their own footwear." The table quieted. Emmeline set down her glass. "My father," she said, "mends his boots because he believes that wastefulness is a sin. He also believes that a man's character is better measured by what he repairs than by what he discards." She paused. "I have always found that principle useful." Lady Saxby's smile thinned but held. "How delightful. And does the Duke share this philosophy?" Lucian's voice came from the head of the table, not loud, but carrying. "My wife's father is a man of greater principle than anyone else in this room, Lady Saxby, including myself." He lifted his glass. "A quality I intend to learn from." The silence that followed was exquisite. Lady Saxby did not speak again for the remainder of the evening. The Countess of Harlow changed the subject with the practiced efficiency of a woman who had been diffusing social explosions for 30 years, and the dinner continued, and Emmeline ate her food and did not look at her husband and felt something behind her ribs that she was not yet prepared to name. In the carriage home, the horse's hooves beat a steady rhythm against the road, and the summer darkness pressed against the windows, and they sat in silence for several minutes. Emmeline watched the hedgerows pass, black shapes against a sky that still held the faintest memory of daylight at this hour in July, and she was aware of her own heartbeat and of his breathing and of the strange intimacy of a shared carriage after a public evening, when the performance drops away and what remains is simply two people and the things they have not yet said. "Thank you," she said. "I did not say it for you." He paused. "I said it because it was true. Those are not mutually exclusive." He turned his head. In the darkness of the carriage, with only the lanterns outside casting shifting light across his features, he looked younger than his 34 years, and more uncertain, and she understood that this was the version of him that existed when no one was watching, the version that did not know how to be anything other than the Duke, and was only now discovering that he might also be something else. "Emmeline," he said. It was the first time he had used her Christian name without the prefix of formality. "Yes?" "I'm glad you stopped the wedding," she looked at him. "Are you? If you had not, if you had simply said your vows and submitted, I would have spent this marriage believing I had a wife who agreed with me in all things. I would never have known that I had a wife who could disagree with me and still remain." He turned back toward the window. "That is worth considerably more." The months turned. Emmeline's changes to the household settled into permanence, not through imposition, but through the steady accumulation of competence that makes resistance feel foolish. Mrs. Fenn deferred to her on all domestic matters. Barrow consulted her on tenant concerns and discovered that her suggestions were practical, informed, and occasionally better than his own. The gardens, which had been maintained but not loved, began to change under her attention. She worked through the head gardener, not in the soil herself, but her eye for color and structure transformed the south borders into something visitors remarked upon. Her father's benefice was arranged by September. Reverend Bryce took up the living at Renbury, a village 8 miles from Northmere, with a good house and a generous income, and a congregation who found his sermons thoughtful and his manner kind. Her sisters visited at Christmas, two young women who walked through the great hall of Northmere Park with wide eyes and careful steps, and Lucian, who had agreed to their visit with the resigned tolerance of a man bracing for disruption, found himself teaching the younger one to play chess and losing twice. "Your sister," he told Emmeline that evening, "is a menace. She learned from me." "That," he said, "explains a great deal." She laughed. It was the first time she had laughed freely in his presence, and the sound of it stopped him where he stood, and she saw in his face the precise moment when something that had been forming for months finally arrived, not as a revelation, but as a recognition, quiet and irrevocable, of what had been true for longer than he had admitted. He did not say it that night. He was not a man who rushed toward declarations. But the following morning, he came to the breakfast room early, earlier than his custom, and sat across from her and watched her pour her tea and said, "I have written to Lady Saxby to inform her that she is no longer welcome at Northmere." Emmeline looked up. "On what grounds?" "On the grounds that she insulted my wife, and I tolerated it for 6 weeks longer than I should have. That was months ago. Yes, I'm slower than you in most things. I'm learning to accept that." She set down her teacup. "Lucian." "Yes?" "You do not need to banish people on my account." "I know. I'm banishing her on mine. I do not wish to sit at dinner with people who cannot recognize what is extraordinary when it is placed directly in front of them." He paused. "I spent 34 years making the same error. I do not intend to watch others repeat it in my house." The letter was sent. Lady Saxby received it with the particular fury of a woman who has been dismissed by someone whose approval she had always assumed was guaranteed, and she spoke of the Duke and his country wife in every drawing room that would receive her, and the drawing rooms received her less and less frequently as the season turned, because the ton had watched Emmeline at 3 balls and 2 dinners and a concert, and had reached its own conclusions about which woman in the equation was worth knowing. Their first child was born the following spring, a daughter whom they named after Emmeline's mother. She had her father's dark eyes and her mother's composure, and she screamed with remarkable vigor for 3 hours after her birth. And Lucian held her in the corridor outside the bedchamber and looked at his daughter's furious red face and said, "She is already disagreeing with me." "Good," Emmeline said from the bed, exhausted and luminous. "She should start early." 2 years later, a son, and then a second daughter. And the house at Northmere filled in a way it had not been filled in living memory, not with noise precisely, but with presence, with the particular texture of a family that had been built not from obligation, but from negotiation, adjustment, and the slow accumulation of chosen trust. Bishop Ogilvy, who was invited to the christening of the eldest girl, told the story of the wedding to anyone who asked and several who did not. He told it with increasing admiration over the years, and by the time he retired, the story had acquired the quality of a parable. The bride who stopped her own wedding, the Duke who sat down and listened, the marriage that was better for having nearly not happened. "In 41 years, he said at his retirement dinner, "I performed over 2,000 marriages, and the finest of them was the one that stopped halfway through." Lucian, who heard this second hand from the curate at Renbury, repeated it to Emmeline over breakfast. She smiled. She did not say anything for a moment, and then she said, "He was very patient, the bishop. He did not rush us. He was terrified. Yes, but patient." Lucian reached across the table. His hand covered hers as it had on the first day when they walked from the altar together, and the pressure of his fingers was no longer tentative. It was certain, the certainty of a man who had learned, slowly and with difficulty and against every habit of his life, that the strongest foundation for a marriage is not obedience, but the willingness of two people to remain in the room until they understand each other. Outside, the June sun fell across the south gardens that Emmeline had designed and the parkland that stretched toward the village of Renbury, where Reverend Bryce was composing his Sunday sermon in a study that smelled of old books and did not leak. The children were in the nursery with their nurse, and the house was quiet in the way that only a well-run house can be, not empty but settled, not silent but at peace. And somewhere in the vestry of St. Bartholomew's, the parish register still held the record of their marriage, with a date and two signatures, and no indication whatsoever of the 23 minutes between the first attempt and the second. Some things, Emmeline reflected, do not require a record. They require only that the people who lived them remember what it cost to get them right, and that they do not forget. They arrive here like a word spoken before it could be swallowed whenever they are ready.